U.S. officials say that the suspect behind the recent deadly shooting in Buffalo intended to take as many black lives as he possibly could. Heavy fighting reported in the east of Ukraine as Russian forces are trying to encircle Ukrainian fighters in the Donbas region. The British Prime Minister says his government will set out plans to allow ministers to unilaterally scrap parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Good to have you with us. Now, people in the U.S. city of Buffalo have held a vigil to mourn 10 people shot and killed by an alleged white supremacist teenager. The gunman also wounded three in what authorities called an act of racially motivated violent extremism. Nearly a dozen of those hit by gunfire in a supermarket on Saturday were black. Police now investigating the crime, and they say that 18-year-old Peyton Gendron is now in custody. He was live streaming his carnage. The city's mayor says that the killer's express purpose was to take as many black lives as possible. He's been charged with first-degree murder in another act of gun violence in California. A shooting at a church left one person dead and five others injured on Sunday. Officials say four of those injured are in critical condition. We're joined by Frank Speck, an emeritus professor from the University of Wisconsin, and he says that white supremacy is a core belief in the U.S. and has been part of the country's culture for two centuries.
Lately, of course, people recognize that there's a shift demographically. And everybody says that, you know, in 10 years or 20 years, white people will be a minority. Well, if for 200 years of the country's existence, more or less, white supremacy was part of the culture, part of the legal business here. It's very, very hard to all of a sudden say, well, that's all gone, in a deep way. Not necessarily people running around saying, well, I'm a white supremacist, but a really sort of core belief in part of the country. And that is what got expression and is expressed by the supremacy theory, by the replacement theory, and hence extraordinarily dangerous in a society like ours, where guns are very, very widely available and people use them.
Russia is trying to encircle Ukrainian forces in the Donbas region and fend off a counteroffensive around the city of Izium in the east amid the war between the two neighbors. Latest reports indicate that Russia has pummeled new positions in eastern Ukraine. The main target has been Ukrainian command centers and arsenals in the Russian-controlled city of Izium. Moscow says it's hit those positions with missiles. Ukraine says it repelled more than 15 Russian attacks on Sunday, destroying almost a dozen pieces of Russian equipment, including helicopters, cruise missiles, and drones. Izium is a strategic gateway to the Donbas region, an area largely controlled by Russian-backed forces. More than 80 days have passed since the beginning of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. Russia is calling the membership of Finland and Sweden, the NATO military alliance, a mistake with far-reaching consequences. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the move will radically change the global situation. He warned that the two Scandinavian countries should have no illusions that Russia will simply put up with their decision. The remark came as Swedish and Finnish leaders announced their intent to join NATO after decades of military neutrality. The foreign ministers of the alliance are now in the German capital to focus on the membership bids of Finland and Sweden. Aside from Russia, which views NATO expansion as a threat to its security, Turkey is also objecting to the move. The Secretary General of the Western Military Alliance, NATO, says that Ukraine is capable of defeating Russia, adding that Europe and North America are united in supporting Kyiv.
But Ukraine stands. NATO is stronger than ever. Europe and North America are solidly united. Ukraine can win this war. Ukrainians are bravely defending their homeland. Discuss our strong support.
Now, speaking virtually at a NATO meeting in Berlin, Jens Stoltenberg urged the alliance to keep sending military aid to Ukraine. His call was echoed by German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, and she stressed that NATO members are ready to provide military assistance to Ukraine for as long as needed to help it repel Russia's invasion. She said that NATO should help Ukraine defend itself. Now, this as the United States has already set aside some $40 billion in military and financial assistance to Ukraine. Jana Miller joined us a short while ago to discuss the latest developments in Ukraine. It says NATO needs much more effort to help Kyiv make advances in the current war with Russia.
The United States recently said they're going to give Ukraine around 40 or 50 billion U.S. dollars. But so much of that money will go to arms manufacturers in the United States. It will go on things like insurance and transport. And the fear is also that Russia, with air superiority inside Ukraine, is able to attack any of these missiles before they get to the front. It's easy to transport small arms, for example. You can transport them in civilian cars or in ambulances. But transporting large pieces like artillery, which is what the Ukrainians need, that's very difficult. And the Russians are able to attack those before they get to the front, because at the moment Ukrainians say they're winning, but when I say it's difficult to see how the Ukrainians can win this war, Russia essentially does have air superiority and huge artillery power, and Ukraine has none of that. And just getting these weapons to the front is going to be difficult. That's why at the moment, while the Ukrainians claim they're winning, they're also saying the next few weeks are going to be very, very tough. But at the moment, NATO is going to have to do a lot more if it does want Ukraine to win this war.
The post-Brexit trading arrangement remains a source of friction between the UK and the EU. Now, the British Prime Minister is saying that his government will set up plans to allow ministers to unilaterally scrap part of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Boris Johnson says that the protocol had unintended consequences for the UK. He added that there will be a necessity for London to act if the EU does not change its stance. Johnson underlined that his government is responsible to assure consumers, citizens, and businesses of Northern Ireland that they are protected in the long term. And that has raised alarm in the bloc, which sees Britain's move a violation of the Brexit deal. EU member Ireland has urged the UK not to breach the accord by introducing new trade laws.
Unfortunately, it has been the briefings that has come from the British government this week that has raised a real red flag in Dublin and in Brussels. Because the British government is now threatening to break international law, to break a treaty that they signed with the EU and that they designed with the EU and ratified with a huge majority in the House of Commons. And in doing so, potentially creating huge problems on the island of Ireland. And while there are issues...
The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's Brexit deal with the EU. That effectively created a customs border in the sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, because of the province's open land border with EU member Ireland. Tensions surfaced over the issue after last week's elections in Northern Ireland. The largest unionist party there is now threatening not to take part in the government unless the protocol is abandoned. Iran says it is in serious in the negotiations for the revival of the 2015 agreement, but is also determined not to place its trust in the enemy for immunity from sanctions. Chief negotiator in the Vienna talks, Ali Babarakeni, says that Tehran is serious in the discussions and fulfillment of its international obligations. He, however, said that all diplomatic potential should be used in line with national interests without reliance on foreigners. Babarakeni says that the foreign ministry is using every means to remove the sanctions while also tapping into every international potential to improve Iran's ability to neutralize the bans. Tehran had earlier said an agreement in the Vienna talks hinges on the U.S.'s political decision for the removal of sanctions and guarantees that they will not be reimposed. Now, Tehran says it will take its complaint to international bodies over the detention of one of its diplomats in Belgium. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the arrest of Asadullah Asadi in Germany, his extradition to Belgium, his trial and the verdict that he received have all been illegal. Asadi was detained in Germany and sentenced to 20 years in prison in Belgium in 2018 after being accused of setting up a bomb attack against anti-Iran terrorist group, MKO. The spokesman says it's regrettable that Esadi's basic rights as a human have been violated while in detention. He said that the arrest has set a new precedent in diplomatic law. Hatibzadeh says that this is a clear violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which stipulates that diplomats are immune from prosecution in their host countries. Now, in other news, a convoy of around 70 oil tankers belonging to the U.S. military has reportedly crossed from Syria's Hasakha province into Iraq. This is the latest attempt by the U.S. to smuggle Syrian crude from the legally seized oil wells in the country's north. The tankers were reportedly accompanied by a number of trucks carrying military equipment and several armored vehicles. On Friday, another convoy of U.S. trucks was seen crossing into Iraq from the same area. U.S. troops and the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces are in control of most of the oil fields in the Syrian province of Hasakha and Deir al-Zor. They have been regularly smuggling Syrian oil out of the country to sell it abroad. Damascus has repeatedly condemned the U.S. move as state piracy. From Damascus, I'm joined by Mohammed Ali, our correspondent there. Mohammed, good to have you with us. So this has been going on. Looks like it's been for quite some while. And former president in the U.S., Donald Trump, said that U.S. forces will remain there to secure oil, but looks like they're securing oil for their own benefit, not for Syrians.
Well, definitely, the U.S. Presence is aimed to, in Syria is aimed to serve the interests of the U.S., definitely not the interests of the Syrian people. And we've been seeing that due to the acts that U.S. troops in Syria have been carrying out since they occupied that part of Syria in the north and in the northeast. Now, the recent developments was that the U.S. troops in Syria smuggled oil again out of the country to northern Iraq, about 70 vehicles, including oil tankers, crossed from Syria into northern Iraq via Al-Yarubiya illegal border crossing. They were accompanied by six U.S. armored vehicles over there, and this comes just one day following also smuggling oil via 46 trucks from that same area in Hasakha countryside towards Iraq. Now, this has been going on for years. If you ask analysts why, what the U.S. is doing, it's actually looting the oil, selling some of them, and using also a part of that oil to finance its occupation and illegal presence inside Syria. And some of that oil goes to the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which the U.S. Directly supports in that part of Syria. Eventually, the result, of course, is a negative one with regards the impact, of course, with regards to the impact on the Syrian people. Due to the occupation of the U.S. Forces over there in that part of the country, most of the Syrians inside Syria are deprived from their rights in those natural resources and the oil. And as a result, prices have been going higher and higher every day. And there is still international silence, and the U.S. continues to occupy that part of Syria.
And Mohammed, also let us know if the Damascus government is planning to do something about this.
Well, the Syrian government does not give details on its plans or strategies with regards to such issues. But however, officials in Syria always point out that the Syrian army will eventually liberate every inch of Syrian territory. Of course, there are priorities. First, the Syrian government has to fight terrorism and purge the country entirely from terrorism, perhaps. And then this strategy will go on to liberate those areas inside Syria, whether from the Israeli occupation in the south, the Turkish occupation in the north, and the U.S. occupation. It's definitely a difficult situation inside Syria. We have to point out that there are terrorists that have been coming into Syria from over 70 states, and the Syrian government has a lot of duties in order to perhaps restore security entirely and liberate all parts of the country, whether from terrorism or from occupying countries.
Okay, thanks for that. Mohammed Ali in Damascus. Now, vote counting is underway in Lebanon, where people went to the ballot boxes to choose a new parliament. results are expected today. The Interior Ministry put the turnout at just over 40%. Nearly 4 million people were eligible to vote. 128 seats are up for grabs. Over 700 candidates competed to enter the parliament. The elections are held amid an unprecedented economic crisis that began in 2019. The crisis has led to a currency collapse and plunged over 70% of the population to poverty. Hezbollah resistance movement has blamed the crisis on a U.S.-led conspiracy against the country. The next parliament is due to vote on key reforms required by the International Monetary Fund to unlock financial support. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Bira. The protesters were out on the streets to mark the anniversary of Nakba Day, the day of catastrophe. That's when Israel was created, 74 years ago. Soldiers used tear gas and live ammunition to disperse the demonstrators. Protesters waved Palestinian flags and denounced Israeli crimes. They held placards with signs stressing their right to return to their ancestral land. Protesters also carried pictures of journalist Shireen Abu Akla, who was fatally shot by Israeli forces on Wednesday. Similar events were held in other West Bank cities as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Well, let me add some verjuice. Very sour. This stew shouldn't be that sour. What can I do now? I'd better not to add the dried lime to the stew. Oh, what a mixture would it turn out to be. Well, today I have two guests and I'm cooking for them. This is gourmet sabzi, one of the most delicious and popular meals in Iran. And in the evening, I'm going to take my guests to one of the delicious streets of Tehran, to Sietiri Street, the center of street foods. Sietiri Street is located at District 12. This street is one of the oldest streets of Tehran. The most important monuments of this street include the National Museum of Iran, St. Peter's Church, Obgyne Museum, Tehran Industrial Vocational School, Iranian National Museum of Science and Technology, and Hayyim Synagogue. Since past times, Siyatir Street has been known as a tourist attraction site of Tehran. Most of the historical sites of Tehran, which have been registered by the heritage sites, are located in this street. Due to the existence of a hospital in this street, Siyatir used to be known as Marizkhane Street, literally Hospital Street. This old hospital is still standing tall, but its name has changed to Sina Hospital. I am now at the beginning of Siyatir Street. Here, so crowded. Siyatir Street is the center of street foods in Tehran. Just beside me, there is a stand which has a really big brass samovar. This stand sells fragrant Iranian tea with different flavors, with rose, cardamom, and cinnamon. I have bought a cup of cinnamon tea. I love this flavor. Still hot. I have to wait a bit more. And this stand sells ice cream and cold Iranian sharbats. Sharbat sekanjabin, which is one of the oldest Iranian drinks made of honey and vinegar. Well, sour cherry sharbat and khakeshir sharbat, which are all among the most popular drinks in Iran. Oh, look at here. This stand sells different types of Iranian kebab on barbecue. Oh, what a great smell. And now let's learn about the opinion of people concerning this street.
My children had not seen this street before, so we decided to visit here and have fun.
Here's a cobblestone street, which gives the sense of old Tehran.
I suggest those tourists who come to Tehran from other countries to visit this street.
Whenever I happen to come by this part of the city, I visit this street. It's a cobblestone street.
It's spectacular. I have come here with my friends for the second time. It's an amazing place.
It's a really different experience, eating on the street and beside the people.
The weather is great here in Siyatir Street, and across from me, there is the National Museum of Iran.
Siyatir is one of the must-see sites of Tehran. Here is full of life. The cheerful voice of people is a sign of their hope to the future in beautiful Iran. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
May 15 marks 74 years of al-Nakba, the Palestinian experience of dispossession and loss of their homeland. This is what the creation of Israel did to their homeland, and to this day, Palestinians and the world are marking this day. The question is, why haven't there been major strides made for the cause of Palestine or their rights? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why international law continues to be broken by Israel on things like settlement building or home demolitions, and more importantly, how it has gotten away with murder. Will that be the case of the assassinated reporter, Shireen Abu Akleh? First, let's find out the latest on this day. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. Mona, obviously this is a day that is marked every year, but I think this year, given the fact that we had this assassination take place of the reporter, maybe things are up a notch or two in terms of the level of intensity out there.
Well, every year Palestinians commemorate their Nakba catastrophe. For 74 years, Palestinians have been commemorating this painful and heart-breaking anniversary for the Palestinians. We have to mention that since the forced expulsion of Palestinians, of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes by Zionist groups who forced the Palestinians from their homeland in order to allow Jewish immigrants into the Palestinian land, since that day, the Israeli crimes, Israeli aggression and violence against the Palestinians didn't stop. It was an ethnic cleansing policy inside the lands that were occupied in 1948. The same thing is being carried out here in the occupied West Bank. In Al-Quds as well, Palestinians are still suffering in the Gaza Strip. Millions of Palestinians are refugees today. It's not about their ancestors who left their homeland in 1948. Palestinian refugees are living in the diaspora in many Palestinian refugee camps in Arab countries like Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, here in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds, as well as in the Gaza Strip. But like today, Palestinians say despite the Israeli aggression, despite the Israeli violence, despite the settlers' crimes and the confiscation of Palestinian lands, expansion of illegal settlements, but Palestinians today and maybe day after day, they are even more adherent to their inalienable right, to their right to return to their homes, to their villages, regardless of the fact that the Israeli regime is doing their utmost to let the world forget about the refugees issue. But Palestinians today, and through these demonstrations and protests that were carried out in the occupied West Bank as well as in the Gaza Strip, Palestinians today are saying that they are even more adherent to their right to return to their homes, and they have the right to continue resisting the Israeli occupation in order to bring it to an end.
Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil there from Occupy Ramallah. Let me introduce our guest now for this edition of The Spotlight. Hafsakara Mustafa joins us. She's a journalist and Middle East expert who joins us from London. Also joining us, Amal Wahdan, a Palestinian human rights advocate who joins us from occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and Hafsakara Mustafa, let me first start with you. If the facts are right, based on what has happened when Nakba occurred, 78% of historic Palestine ethnically cleansed, 530 villages destroyed, and about 15,000 Palestinians to have been killed in a series of mass atrocities that it was called, with 70 massacres. One outlet has mentioned this. I mean, if you have something that's created by these acts, doesn't it mean that it is doomed to fail?
Well, the Nakba is obviously a catastrophe that has befallen the Palestinian people, and one that is constantly remembered by the Palestinian people every year, but also is revived every year because the Palestinian people are experiencing an annual Nakba. I mean, very recently, obviously, we've seen the murder of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, and then the atrocious behavior during her funeral procession. So the Palestinians are experiencing the catastrophe of the Nakba almost every year, with the complicity of the world powers who were watching and actually even changing the narrative. So we've obviously as well seen the way Western media has either chosen to look the other way or actually whitewash what has happened or downplay the severity of the crime. So there was a Nakba over 70 years ago, and there is a Nakba annually ever since. There's been a Nakba every year ever since. And this year, of course, has been a particularly painful one, given the events we've seen. And unfortunately, as things appear, it seems that this coming year for Palestinians will be just as catastrophic as the past ones we've seen before.
So if we were to take a look at what Israel has achieved, Amal Wahdan, throughout these past 74 years, what can be said about that? We're looking at them executing illegal acts on a daily basis. They are breaking international law. They've been categorized as an apartheid regime. You have Israelis that are fleeing Israel, actually, and their security is still in danger. So what have been their accomplishments?
For us means colonization. They were given this right, between brackets, to build a state at the expense of the Palestinians. The ethnic cleansing of 1948, which what you said absolutely right, it's ethnic cleansing war, and that's what how we define it. When they forced out about a million Palestinians outside of their homes, destroyed over 500 villages, destroyed and burned more than 500 villages, and committed genocide against Palestinians. Scores of massacres took place in 1948. One of the most popular one is Deir Yassin, where they killed about 253 Palestinians, burned the corpse of about 100 of them, and they took a bunch of them and walked through the streets of Jerusalem to terrorize other Palestinians. Actually, this was a real alert to other Palestinians. It scared Palestinians, and which forced them gradually up to the north or to the east to scare the massacres. And accomplishment, according to the Israelis, is building a state at the expense of other people, displacing, dispossession of Palestinians out of their villages, out of their cities, outside the countries, and refusing to let them in, despite so many UN resolutions, like 194, right of return for Palestinians. Up till now, we have 7 million people living in more than 62 refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza. Half a million people live within what they call Israel, which is occupied Palestine of 1967. They were displaced from their villages, and they forced to live in other villages inside 1948 and up until now. And regardless sure. of so many efforts and legal cases, they cannot go back to their homes again.
Let's take
all these Palestinians.
Yeah, let's take that point up with Hafsakar Mustafa. I know the audio connection is not that great, but this is about the right of return, which our guest was talking about there. And she mentioned a figure of 7 million, and that's a lot. And you would think that throughout all these years, if anything, there should have been some kind of political will from the respective countries that these Palestinians are in, particularly the Arab countries that they're in, from the Arab leaders to have done something to get some kind of, at least a percentage of them back to the homeland, but that wasn't done. Why do you think that has happened? Again, we're talking about a length of time here that's going on decades now.
Of course, and I think the role of Arab leaderships, and particularly more recently, has been atrocious because it has made a bad situation worse. And obviously, in light of what we're seeing more recently, I think it's absolutely astonishing that there hasn't been a suspension of relations with Israel with the newly formed relationships that have happened in the past few years. But again, I mean, the failure of Arab governments to actually tackle this issue more forcefully is astonishing. And I think it's also more worrying given that there is actually a political leverage that many Arab countries have, namely with resources such as oil and gas, which could be withheld or reduced in exchange for more rights for Palestinians, for instance, at a time where tensions are high with Russia and European economies are very reliant on Russian gas. So there is room for maneuver for many Arab countries to tackle this issue, but they're simply failing to do that. And it is very frustrating. And of course, it's even more frustrating to see that, again, in light of the Russian crisis, we're seeing Israelis bring in thousands upon thousands of Ukrainians on the basis that they're simply Jewish, and therefore they can replace the indigenous Palestinian population simply by virtue of claiming some sort of Jewish ancestry, when the actual population of Palestine is expelled on a daily basis, is even more frustrating. But again, this is the situation we have with the terrorist state of Israel and terrorist governments, really Western governments, that are accomplices in this and that are supporting Israel in its terrorist activities, sadly.
Yeah, I'm looking down a list of stuff that I'd like to discuss with you, Amal Watan, here. And one of the things that doesn't get mentioned much, even though I think it's probably one of the most important ones, is the enactment of what's called the nation state of the Jewish people. It doesn't get mentioned much except for when it came out. Can you tell us what that is and how that endangers Palestinians' existence on their own land?
Well, first of all, there is no by international law to carve Palestine from the homeland of Greater Syria and give it or grant it to the Jewish people in order to establish their Jewish homeland. Why would they do something like this unless it is for the interest of the colonial powers at that time? Even in 1922, when the British mandate was over Palestine, started over Palestine, It was also against international law. Who gave them this authority? Who gave these colonial powers the right to carve Palestine and give it to another people who do not relate to this land at all? They gathered like probably over 60 or 70 Jewish, 70 nations, Jewish from 70 nations, and brought them into Palestine where they do not belong. Actually, Ethiopians, for example, Arab Jews whom they brought from Morocco, from Yemen, from Iraq, from other parts of the Arab world, why would they bring these people in here unless there is a scheme? First, the Zionist project, which actually goes along with the colonial power interest in this area. They wanted to build a military base for the colonial powers in this geography here to suit the colonial powers. So this was given in false grounds. It's against international law. It's against human rights law. Even the General Assembly has no jurisdiction to give such a law or such a resolution, the partition of 1948, they don't have any right to do such because it's not under their mandate to partition part of a land and give it to another people. But they did because the US, the UK, and their allies decided to do so. And that's how this whole thing started, actually. Mm-hmm. And the Zionist movement has its own terrorist gangs, which terrorized the people to force them out of the land. They wanted a clean land from the Arabs, from its indigenous people. And the Arab countries at that time, the reactionary Arab countries at that time, didn't budge. And they continue to do the same role. They continued, actually, since 1948. This didn't change. The Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, they played according to the U.S. scheme.
Right.
They wanted this land empty of any Arab.
Sure.
Otherwise, what would an Ethiopian, with all respect to all people, but what would Ethiopians, how would they relate to such land? This land has its own people, and Palestinians and Arabs in this part of the
okay.
world go back to 10,000 years.
Sure,
so
sure.
There is no legal ground or human ground for any international institution to replace the indigenous people with people from all from the whole world, from countries of, and nations of the whole world.
Let's bring Hafsa Qara Mustafa into this. Hafsa Qara Mustafa, maybe at no other time in recent memory have we seen, in a span of about a month to 6 weeks, what we have witnessed in the occupied territories, particularly starting with the month of Ramadan, where you had the Al-Quds being vandalized and being desecrated. You had the Palestinians that were beaten, handcuffed. You had the settlers who came into the mosque, I think just a couple of days ago that happened, escorted by Israeli police. And you also had, for example, what happened in Tel Aviv with an act of resistance, as it was called. It took the lives of some Israelis, a Palestinian that did that. And then you had Al-Quds Day, where after 2 years, hundreds of thousands of people came out across the world, which could add up to even more. And then you had what topped that, in a sense, which was unfortunate assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh, the reporter that everybody's still mourning. So we've seen what has happened. The outpouring of people, in terms of the numbers, is my question to you. When you have all these people to have come out, whether it's at the funeral procession or whether it was Al-Quds Day or otherwise, how can we channel all that energy in order to fight for Palestinian rights in terms of the numbers that we saw?
Again, I think it's. I mean, the numbers are there, but I think the political will from governments, including from governments that should be sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, is not materializing. And I think that's the problem. Because if you look at, for instance, the media, there is a completely, there's a very clear distinction between the sentiment, the overall sentiment, whether it's on Palestine, whether it's on the Russia and Ukraine issue, and what the media is portraying. And the media tries to reflect what the governments are trying to say or trying to sell. And that's where the problem lies, because there is a distinction between what the people are saying and doing and feeling, in particular towards Palestine, and what their governments are doing. So I think that that energy should be challenged against individual governments, because it's very easy to sort of perhaps write or say something against Israel. We know Israel is the culprit, that it goes beyond any doubt. But actually, if each individual country challenged their own governments and their own elected officials, then that would have some impact, because it's these politicians that are aiding and abetting what Israel is doing. For instance, in the US, congressmen and congresswomen who are on the payroll of Israeli lobbies are actually going into the Congress to fight Israel's battle. So if American voters, for instance, pressured them into acting on behalf, at the very least, of Americans instead of Israel, there would be a shift in action. The same with the UK, for instance. If MPs were being held to account by the electorate and said, well, actually, Israel is a non-vote, it doesn't help you get votes, then things would change. But so I think the way to do this is to channel energy at each country, at each individual country. Continue to blame Israel, of course. Stop relying on certain Arab governments, because they're lost. And actually lobby each and every Western government. Wherever you have pro-Palestinian voices, they need to lobby their own governments and their own local politicians.
Is that something that you see being a viable way forward, but with more intensity, Amal Wahdan?
Yes, of course. Foreign supporters and support groups in different parts of the world means a lot to the Palestinian struggle for their right, and for their liberty. And we can see that it is advancing, actually. They have accomplished a lot in their countries with their MPs and with their BDS movement, boycotting and divesting from apartheid Israel. And this is also very helpful for our struggle as Palestinians. But also here in our homeland, the Palestinians have to advance their struggle against this apartheid regime here. And they have to unite their effort on the ground, and they have to unite with other liberation movement, Arab liberation movement around us, and the resistance, axis of resistance, of course, because together we can stand against and defy the U.S. Coalition Operation Room, which it's equipped with everything that can prevent us from advancing forward. And from the other hand, people's power on the ground can defy the Israeli apartheid regime and can defy as well the U.S. Complicity with this apartheid regime.
Okay.
There is a lot to be done together with the international community, with the free people of the world, in order to achieve our right on the ground.
Last question goes to Hafsakar Mostafa. We have to mention this because we just need to, because it's one of the biggest stains, I think, that Israel is continuing to exercise, and that is what's happening in the Gaza Strip. I mean, really, that is just something that's unbelievable in the siege. What can we expect from the resistance groups, of which they've tried to do what they can, in terms of standing up for the Palestinian rights? Do they need to do more?
We go back to the funeral of fellow journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The fact that she's a Christian woman who was supported and taken to her grave by Muslims and Christians alike is something that is very disturbing to Israelis, because that implies that if Muslims and Christian Palestinians unite, then they're a force to be reckoned with. And I think that sense of unity is one that we should be looking to thrive for at every level. So again, Hamas and the PLO need to work together and need to work in order to unite the Palestinian people. I think we need to work through all the differences that are happening today across the Muslim Arab world, the wider Middle East, and full unity in order to challenge the terrorist state of Israel.
Thank you very much for that. Hafsakar Mustafa, journalist and Middle East expert from London. And Amal Wahdan, thank you, Palestinian human rights advocate from Ramallah, of which we had Mona Kandil at the top of the spotlight, our correspondent. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners from all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIV English Radio. Like always, we have invited a scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, to the show to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Usually, we are trying to answer doubts or misconceptions and Islamic beliefs, the doubts which have been asked by different questioners from around the world. The question of the day that we want to talk about is about disclosing our belief in Islam. Why should we clearly and disclosely say that we are Muslims? Is it accepted, and is it good to actually to hide our beliefs as a Muslim? Or no, we need to clearly and openly and outspokenly say that, okay, we are, alhamdulillah, we are Muslims. So what is the best way to tackle this issue? This is what we are going to ask from respected guest to speak of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very glad to be here.
Thanks, Sheikh, and it's a great pleasure for us to have you here. Sheikh, some believe that they don't need to disclose and to declare that they are Muslims. And they say that, okay, just that I believe in Islam and Islamic laws, that's enough for me. Because the I think it might be related to some other topics that we have discussed earlier. They said, okay, others have their own beliefs and I don't want to, let's say, touch other beliefs and to violate their rights. So is it violation of other rights to say that, okay, I'm Muslim? What's good and what's bad on that to say that I am Muslim? Clearly say that, because when I am a good Muslim and I am practicing Islam in the, let's say, best of my efforts, so it would be even a good role model for others to say, okay, he is a Muslim and he is practicing Islam well, and he, I think it's much more better. So is it even narrated, or is it even asked from us to hide our beliefs, not to say that we are Muslims, to hide our Islam? Is it the time for hiding our Islam, our beliefs? Or so what is this, let's say, new trends and tendencies that some have, and they say that we need to hide our beliefs, and as far as we are practicing Islam, that is enough?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that's true. Unfortunately, we see among the Muslim community some people that believe that I need to hide my faith. This is my personal affair. Mm. I have my faith inside my heart. And there is no need to express my faith publicly. And there is no need even to practice it in public. Yep. Let's say I have my faith, I have my righteous action inside my home, within my family members. I have it, I practice it. But when I go out in public, maybe sometimes it requires me to have hijab, maybe talking about the, female Muslim. And when you have social responsibilities or social duties, it doesn't matter. There is no need to express that. There is no need to show it publicly.
True.
I want to say that, of course, this trend that you mentioned, that unfortunately we have these tendency within our Islamic Ummah, especially to some people living in maybe in some of the Western countries. I want to say that sometimes we need to stand by our faith, to show it, to indicate it. You know, it's true that we have the faith inside us. First of all, it is us that we have to have a strong faith to establish my personality. This is very important. But after all, sometimes it requires me to show it and to indicate it in public. Because as I said, we have two kind of duties. First of all, personal duties. And second, we have societal duties. For example, sometimes my faith requires me to go publicly outside and to demonstrate against the aggressive, people.
Arrogant powers.
Arrogant powers, yes. To do some demonstration against those people who are, who are doing injustice toward innocent people. Mm-hmm. I need to go out to show and to indicate my disagreement to those people. This is my societal duty, okay?
Yeah.
When I see in public that some people having injustice toward other people, I need to stop that.
Very true.
I need to show and to indicate my faith, okay?
Yeah. So what is the necessity of actually having such beliefs and actually propagating and promoting such wrong ideas? Is it bad to be a good role model for Muslims and even for non-Muslims to say that, okay, this is what Islam beautifully says and what expects me to be? So then I think it is the time that we need to ponder on what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said. كُنُوا دَعَةَ النَّاسِ بَغَيْرَ أَلْسَنَتِكُمْ. So we are actually inviting people to Islam by our actions, by our deeds. So what is the necessity of actually finding all these excuses to reach to these wrong conclusions?
I want to say that, maybe unfortunately some people they have this assumption mm-hmm. that this is my personal faith, mm-hmm. this is my personal choice.
This is, let's say, personal look at the Islamic beliefs. But Islam is not something personal, like individual. This is something that actually, this is a prescription for all humanities, and it defines different relations for human being with themselves and with the society, as you said, right?
Yeah, I want to say that Islam starts, first of all, from personal issues, mm-hmm. and then goes to the societal and global issues, mm-hmm. okay? I want to say that you cannot say that I have my personal choice and I want to keep it inside, and I do not need to, share it with others.
Yeah,
you have to be courageous. Mm-hmm. You have to show your faith to other people. Of course, I want to say that it does not mean to to have a kind of route to other faiths, to other faith, and to make trouble and to cause dispute among society. No, I'm not talking about these issues. I want to say that sometimes we need to be courageous
and to
practice Islamic duties our Islamic duties and our societal and personal duties, we have to do it. And sometimes we have public duties mm-hmm. and responsibilities. We have to do that. You can find a lot of examples for that. Okay. I gave the example of hijab for the female Muslim, for women. And then we have the donation. Sometimes you need to have some donation for establishing a mosque.
Yeah.
Or, for example, to other people.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So sometimes we ask and we are recommended to pay something as charity while it's not in public. But